By the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink since January the 5th, 1990. My home group is a Design for Living Big Book Study in Wall, New Jersey. Welcome to the International Convention and to this corrections meeting. As I stated earlier, is there anyone, if there's some people coming in, if there's empty seats next to you, please raise your hand so that the people coming in can see them. So anybody coming in right now, thank you very much. If we could take a moment of silence to do with however anyone wants to treat that moment of silence in gratitude for the AA recoveries over the past 75 years. I am privileged currently to serve as a non-trustee director on the AA World Services Board. And as such, I also serve as a member of the Trustees Corrections Committee. And I've been blessed because I was a Panel 49 delegate, and a couple of years after that, I came back for 4 years and appointed committee member on the Trustees Corrections Committee. And now for the last 2 years as an AAWS director, I've served there. And I guess it's not politically correct, but I love the Trustees Corrections Committee because I love the discussions there that are all about carrying the message that a still suffering alcoholic. It's not about, you know, we all have conversations at any service level, a home group level, about budgets and money and all kinds of things, but I love the conversations about carrying the message that a still suffering alcoholic. And, you know, maybe I have a little biased because I'm sure if I asked for people to just maybe say how many people in this room currently carry a meeting into a local or state correctional facility, I'd be curious how many of you there are in here. Quite a few. Oh, my God. Corrections volunteers are like the special forces, like the Delta Force of Alcoholics Anonymous, in my book. That's just been my experience. They are diehards that take it to the next level all the time. And we have three great speakers who in their professional life work with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm only going to share one or two things. The first thing I want to share is that when I came to San Diego in 1995, I was probably as diehard and agnostic, borderline atheist as you can be. And that was after going to a Joe and Charlie Big Book study and doing everything I thought that AA asked me to do. And I just want to share what happened to me at this very meeting there. Is there was a big crowd like there is here today, and there was a line of people waiting to get in, and there was a guy in front of me, and we started talking, and we didn't have a lot in common, except that we had both been incarcerated, and we had both been sober while incarcerated. And right before that convention, a couple months before in Oklahoma City, there had been a bombing, and it was all over the news, and he had been released from an Oklahoma State prison. And he told me online that every week he showed up to see his parole officer, and every week he said, please let me go to the International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous in San Diego. I could drive there, it's only whatever it is from Oklahoma, 15 hours, I have no idea what it is. And every week his parole officer said, no way, the climate around here, it's not going to happen. And finally he told me that he asked him one too many times, and the guy just blew up at him, cursed him out, and said, listen, there is only two people who can get you to this convention you want to go to, God or the governor. And I'll never forget standing on that line outside that door in San Diego of this guy reaching in his pocket and pulling out a piece of paper like this size. And it was folded up like an old report card of mine that I never showed my parents for like 2 months that had been through the wash and in my jeans. And he opened it up. And I'll never forget looking at it. It was from the governor of Oklahoma, giving him permission to leave Oklahoma and attend the International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. And And I consider that, I always talk about it when I tell my story, that that was the first real significant damage that my agnostic armor suffered in Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not find a reason to explain what I had just witnessed. And that has been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I might have a difficult time recognizing any miracles occurring in myself. But when you're around other alcoholics who are getting better, it is very easy to recognize the miracles in them. And so, for all the corrections volunteers in here today, my heart goes out to you and our thanks. You know, I always say when I'm speaking that if I have a soapbox, it's to make sure that everybody in AA knows is we're not just looking for people who've been locked up and spent all this time in jail, or people who say to me, well, I don't know if I can go in because I'm not sure they want to hear my story because maybe my story's not like theirs. And I always say, you know, if you come where I come from, a lot of us that have been in, once they kick us out, then they won't let us back in again for a little while. It's incredible. First they won't let me out. Then I get out. I'm actually straightening out my life. But now they won't let me back in, even for an hour or two at a time. Because we have certain things we have to clear up in our life. So I always mention to people who don't have paper on them or whose circumstances are different, we need all the volunteers we can get. And we're not looking for people to go in and tell war stories. We're not looking for criminals or convicts. We're looking for alcoholics to go in and share our message of recovery with the still suffering alcoholic. We're not looking for different AA or corrections AA. We're looking to bring the alcoholic who happens to reside in the correctional facility as close to an AA meeting as they could find on the outside as possible, so that when they get out, they know what AA is about. So with that, I want to bring up my first speaker. His name is Bobby. I want to make sure I pronounce this great. Is it Up the Grave? See, I was right the first time. And he works at the Lakin County Correctional Facility in West Virginia. Please help us welcome him. Thanks.
Good afternoon. I am really honored to have been asked to speak at this meeting today. And the longer I've been here and the more I've participated and listened, the more honored I am. But I have to admit that speaking in front of a large group of people such as this is way out of my comfort zone. I mean, this is not my cup of tea. Speaking to a large group of strangers. But then I got to thinking about it. I've been here 3 days, and I have yet to meet a stranger. So I can do this, I think. And I had no idea how big this convention is. But I found out months ago when I first agreed to speak, and I was already getting nervous. And I have a friend that's in the fellowship. And I said, you know, I'm getting a little bit nervous because I'm going to San Antonio this summer to speak at the International Convention. Well, his eyes got about this big, and he said, oh, wow, are you kidding me? He said, there's going to be over 40,000 people there, and the meetings will be so big that they'll be in the Alamo Dome. So talk about my nervousness, but I'm thrilled to be here with you. And about that time, I got an email from Rick from the General Service Office, the convention coordinator. And he gently encouraged me that in the spirit of AA, would I please make my talk personal and informal and about my experience with AA. And to me, that means to talk about the people and the volunteers that I've met through AA. And that's easy for me to do. I can do that because I hold them in such high esteem. The women that bring meetings into my facility, I work in a women's prison, I often refer to them as my angels with skin on them. That's how much they mean to me. So although I was nervous, I have to admit that hanging out with 40,000 or 50,000 AAs for the weekend has intrigued me. Because if there's anything I found with the people that I met in recovery, that they're generally a fun bunch. And I often tell that to the women that I do groups with because I have direct contact with the ladies and do groups. And I often tell them, because they haven't had the experience with the recovery community that I have, and they probably don't think that there's any way that you can have fun without being loaded. And I tell them, hey, ladies, the people that you can hang with out in the recovery community and the people that you can hang with, they're a fun bunch and they're enjoying life. And I tell them they're not a depressed bunch, you know, shuffling around, muttering to themselves how much life sucks because they can't get drunk or high. You know, I tell them they're not like that at all. They're the exact opposite. They're generally people with an attitude of gratitude, grateful for another day of recovery, grateful for second chances. And really, that makes them wonderful people to hang around. So anyhow, I wouldn't have missed this for the world, to hang out with you all for a weekend. So what has been my primary experience with the people that I've met from AA? I would have to say that would be the spirituality of service. More specifically, alcoholics helping themselves and their recovery by helping one another. And what could be more spiritual than that? From what I've read, Bill W. first had that vision himself as he lay in the hospital after his last drinking bout. He said, the thought came to me that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others. That's from Bill's story. I'm sure you recognize it, page 14. And I know the AA volunteers that bring meetings into my facility understand exactly what Bill was talking about. and what he found to be true for himself, that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Page 15. Speaking of the spirituality of giving back, allow me to share a coincidence that I found just a couple weeks ago. I was reading My Name is Bill, a biography of Bill W. by Susan Cheever, and it appears in St. Louis on July 3rd, 1955, just before 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it's quarter to 4. So 55 years ago, to this very hour, Bill Wilson got up to speak at the AA convention and the 20th anniversary celebration. And he read a resolution that he had worked very hard to produce, a resolution that provided the AA program with a structure that allowed the fellowship itself to survive as the sole successor to himself and Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob had passed on a few years before that. So through that resolution, 55 years ago, this hour, Bill W. set up the AA fellowship specifically to help alcoholics help one another. And that's quite a legacy. I think of it as kind of the golden rule with a twist. Help others as they have helped you. And that's what I see today in the people that I meet from AA. Helping others, helping themselves in their recovery, helping others in a spirit of service. Before I started working in corrections, I was just starting into the field of addictions, and I worked in a mental health center just briefly before I started with corrections. And looking back now, even the few connections that I had with AA at that time had to do with this giving back that which was so freely given me. For instance, I worked in a crisis unit with an addictions counselor for the first time, and she was in recovery through AA. And at the time, one thing that I just didn't understand about the AA program, well, there was lots I didn't understand. I mean, I was really new to it. But one thing I didn't understand was, why do people keep going back to meetings after they've been sober for 10, 15, 20 years? I mean, I just couldn't figure that out. It didn't seem to make sense to me that they would still be struggling to stay sober all the time. So I asked her about that. And she shared with me this concept of service. This is where I started to hear about it. And once again, of carrying the message. She shared about being a hopeful example to the still suffering alcoholic, and that you only keep what you have by giving it away. And then I had another brief job in a 28-day program before corrections, and many of the staff there were alcoholics or addicts in recovery. Most of them were 12-steppers. And one day one of those counselors came up to me and she said, "Bobby, have you ever read the Big Book?" I'm not sure if I even knew what the Big Book was at the time. I said, "No." And she said, "Well, why don't you give it a try?" She said, "I think if you're going to be suggesting that people go to AA, you should know something about it, you know, before you do that." That made sense to me. So she handed me a Big Book. She said, "Read pages, if you will, read pages 1 through 164. And I did. Well, I read most of it, I believe. And at that time, I began to understand, even a little bit better, this thing called 12-step recovery. It was really starting to take hold for me, the spirituality of this way of recovery. So that does bring me to my career in corrections. First, let me tell you a little bit about my facility and what I do there. Lakin Correctional Center is in West Columbia, West Virginia. It opened in 2002 as the only women's state prison in the state. The prison houses approximately 450 inmates, all felony offenders, adults. It's a minimum to maximum security prison. I provide substance abuse treatment, and I work directly with the offender population. And in addition to educational and cognitive behavioral programming, I facilitate two psychoeducational groups. One's called Helping Women Recover, and the other is A Woman's Way Through the 12 Steps. And both of those programs have been written by Dr. Stephanie Covington, and she is an expert on gender-specific treatment and issues for women in recovery, and she herself is an alcoholic in long recovery. And I also coordinate AA meetings and coordinate with the fellowship and have volunteers come in, and I attend AA meetings 3 or 4 a week with the inmates, inmate-led meetings in my facility. Now, for many of these inmates, when these women volunteers come in, and it could be men, but we have women volunteers come into our prison. It's the very first contact that they have ever had with women from the outside who are in recovery. And who are these women that I work with, the offenders? The typical offender is in her late 20s to early 30s, has been convicted of a drug crime or a property crime committed while she was under the influence or probably to get money for alcohol or drugs. And although substance abuse and addiction issues are present in almost all of their histories, only a small percentage of them have had any treatment prior to incarceration, and most of them have not even had any connection with AA or NA before they came to prison. These women often have a history of being the victim of childhood abuse, domestic violence. They're typically mothers with several minor children. Before they were incarcerated, they were probably unemployed or on welfare, perhaps didn't graduate from high school. They usually come from families with significant histories of alcoholism and drug addiction and are often following generations of family members into and through the criminal justice system. And they are delightful women. They are just wonderful. I love them. And for many of these women, coming to prison was their rock bottom. However, I often hear them acknowledge that they see that they were rescued rather than arrested. Sadly, however, some of them return after they've been released, usually for drinking and drugging. And while it's clear to me, absolutely clear, that those who lack sober support on the outside are the ones most likely to come back, it is equally clear, there's no doubt about it, that those who get involved in 12-step recovery in the prison and hang with the winners when they are released are the ones most likely to stay sober, alive, and free. Now, earlier I mentioned my angels with skin on them, and some of them are here in the audience today. Without a doubt, my most powerful connection and relationship to AA has been through these women, these volunteers that bring meetings behind the walls of my institution. I was told when I first went to work at the prison that it was my job to start some AA and NA meetings for the inmates, and still I didn't know very much what to do and what that meant. So I got on the internet and I contacted the GSO, and promptly they sent me a telephone number, and they said, you get in touch with Kathy O. from Huntington, West Virginia. Okay, so I made the phone call. And at the time, Kathy was the area corrections chair, and now she's the seated delegate to AA from Area 73, which is the whole state of West Virginia. So let me tell you, and maybe some of you know Kathy in here, but if you do, you know that she's just as full of life as she can be, and she is an absolute dynamo of recovery, AA recovery energy. She talks fast, and she got things going faster at Lakin than you can imagine. In no time at all, she had arranged to come in with Pat T. from her home group to have meetings with the inmates. She then organized two other groups to come in, Allie C. and Connie H. from across the river, and Nancy D.'s group from Charleston, West Virginia. Now, that first phone call was over 7 years ago. That's all I did. One phone call, 7 years ago. And these friends of Bill have been bringing the message into the prison to these women month after month, year after year, for 7 years. Please. Now, this connection between the service that they are providing and their own sobriety and their recovery first became apparent when, after meetings with the outside volunteers, and before I would even have a chance to thank them for coming in, they would usually say to me, thank you for letting us come in to have a meeting with these ladies. I mean, can you imagine that? Thank you for letting us come in. Talk about the spirituality of recovery and of AA service. And that first call was once again 7 years ago, and they're still coming in sharing their spirit, experience, strength, and hope. My angels with skin on them. Now, of course, being a prison, you don't just walk in off the street and do this and bring a meeting in. There are applications to be filled out, background checks to be made, regular orientations and trainings to participate in, rules and dress codes to be followed, pat-downs and other security measures to be submitted to, and a few of them are challenged as they go through the metal detectors because of some procedures that they've had to have along the way. And that's all once you get there in the prison. And that's no easy task getting there. Because I don't know, how many of you have been to West Virginia? Anyone? A few? And it's not part of Virginia, you understand. Okay. This is West, by God, Virginia. Okay. Go Mountaineers. All right. Anyhow, God piled up the state of West Virginia into a truly beautiful state. Almost heaven, some call it. But if you were ever to flatten it out, I believe it would be the biggest state in the Union. It's hard to get around. And these women that have been coming in, they are coming and doing a three-hour round trip just to get to the prison and back. So it's quite a sacrifice and a spiritual service that they're doing, and we so appreciate it. So for the women of Lakin that I work with, and for men and women and juveniles all across the country who have been touched by your service, for carrying the message behind the walls, I'm going to share for them all. Thank you, and we love you, every single one of you. Give yourselves a hand. Come on. Finally, I want to talk about the core group of powerful recovering women within the inmate population. Women who ask themselves each day, what can I do for the woman who is still sick in prison? This group is constantly changing, of course, as some women are released, join the fellowship on the outside, but they're quickly replaced by other women on the inside. Their names are not important, but they are so important to me. They have inspired me with their rigorous honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, their humility, and their service to one another. As they work the steps and begin to realize the promises, indeed miracles happen on the inside through AA and 12-step recovery. One such woman is Holly G. Holly was incarcerated at Lakin perhaps 6 years ago. She attended my groups. She led AA and NA meetings inside the prison. She was paroled. She joined the fellowship, got a sponsor who is one of our AA volunteers. And with her permission, I would like to share parts of a letter that she sent not too long ago. A letter that I share now with every single recovery group that I facilitate. Dear Lord, my life is so blessed. When I was out there, I lived in tents, hotels, in parks and vans, selling drugs, staying drunk and high. Today, I can hardly believe what a far cry from that my life is. God allows me to take a meeting into the local mental institution every Tuesday, and the patients are so appreciative to hear the message of recovery. God also allows me to go into one of the local jails one or two times a month. It's an awesome reminder of where I have come from and where I could quickly go back to should I decide to take my will back. I sponsor three women who are such a blessing in my life, as my sponsor is a blessing to me. I have two service positions at the home group level. I'm currently working the steps for the fourth time. I really feel that this is not my life anymore. If I had paid the consequences of my actions and decisions, I would be dead 10 times over. God, in His great grace, pulled me through so much. So I'm on borrowed time, and that time is God's. So I try to do the best of my ability to turn my will and my life over to Him, all day, every day. I try to be His vessel and try to do the work He wants me to do. And I get it wrong 1,000,000 times a day. But I continue to stumble towards the light, little smiley, happy face here. And for the smallest steps that I take in the right direction, God meets me there and blesses me and walks me through. It's a beautiful life, one that I don't always deserve. I never knew life could be so simple or so good. What a testimony to the power of carrying the message and giving back that which was so freely given me. Spiritual healing and recovery through helping others, just as Bill W. envisioned so long ago. Know that through AA volunteers who carry the message behind walls everywhere, many men and women who hit rock bottom the day those prison doors slammed shut behind them, receive the message and begin their journey of recovery. It's my sincere hope that you have the opportunity to meet some of them as you trudge the road of happy destiny. Thank you so much.
It always amazes me when someone knows our history as well as we know it, to hear someone who is not a member but yet obviously a very great friend to Alcoholics Anonymous. Amazing. Now, I want to touch on something he said to just share with everyone here, is that he talked about Bill's talk in St. Louis. And, you know, if you registered for this convention, you had an option to buy a souvenir AA Comes of Age. And sometimes I hear people talk about, you know, people just go to meetings inside to get coffee or cigarettes and everything else. God, I know people who just go to meetings on the outside to get coffee and cigarettes. I mean, AA inside, you know, is supposed to be the same. And but what amazes me is that book that some of you got, AA Comes of Age, which is one of my favorite books, which documents everything leading up to that point, is now available in hardcover. But you would think that that would be someone's idea, someone from just the best home group in the world that has a GSR and has the perfect group. But that book comes in softcover because an inmate in California who was sober a long time with probably no possibility of getting out, who was helping 12-step other people, became totally interested in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when he asked somebody he was working with how he could learn more about the history, they said AA Comes of Age, but unfortunately it was only available in hardcover, which in some institutions we all know they do not let in. But it's not from an AA member. It's, you know, sometimes people separate AA members inside or outside. It is a letter from an AA member who happens to currently reside in a correctional facility that was written to the General Service Office that convinced them that we should publish this book in soft cover. And as a result, it became a good idea to give as a souvenir for everyone here today. But it is amazing to me that that's where that comes from. And I want to, you know, the last speaker, Bobby, made so many points. But the last time I went through volunteer training, which was for the Monmouth County Correctional Facility in New Jersey, you know, I loved how he talked about AA members, because one of the people there who's a friend of AA and not an AA member, he said he loves AA members because of how crazy we are and how vibrant we are and how just, you know, we're just on a mission. And he gave me the example, and once he told me, I looked around. He said that he loves when it gets to the end of volunteer orientation that's mandatory for all volunteers. And the last section they have in Monmouth County is they put in a videotape, and it's an explanation of the hostage policy. And then they put a release in front of you, and you have to initial a couple of sentences, and then you have to sign it, and you have to acknowledge that you understand they have a no-hostage policy and blah, blah, blah. But he said it always amazes him. He gets a big smile on his face because with all the other volunteers, the social workers and the people from the churches and all, he says people just get this look on their face. He said, but not with the AA people. He said they hardly even read it. He said they just get the paper, they just sign it and give it back. So I paid attention when I went through orientation. He was right. They're playing this video and everybody. And I think that's because, you know, I was once told that the most painful place in a life to be is to be physically alive but spiritually dead. And for those of us that have been in that place and then are spiritually alive, it's almost like, what else can you do to us? Just tell me where to sign and I'll show up. Our next speaker is Nancy McCarthy. She's a regional administrator of the Department of Corrections, Division of Probation and Parole in Missouri. Please help me welcome Nancy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just one follow-up to the story about the hostage situation. When they say that when we count to three, we're going to shoot, they don't really count to three. So duck right away. We were so happy in the state of Missouri when we finally learned that we could take other allowed leave if we were held hostage in a facility. So I don't know. I guess we were going to find a phone and call in sick or take annual leave or what have you. But my name is Nancy McCarthy, and I am consider myself very fortunate to be considered a friend of AA. So thank you. last night, the flag ceremony, before I came, a number of individuals said, where do you see the flag ceremony? It will overwhelm you. And while it did, I think it pales in comparison to the work that you all do by going into facilities, going into probation and parole offices, and doing the work that you do. And so I again applaud you for all that you do. In Missouri, what my responsibility is as a regional administrator is I oversee 10 probation offices and one 500-bed facility. In essence, what we supervise in St. Louis, Missouri is 17,000 individuals who are either on probation or parole supervision. Within the state of Missouri, we have 75,000 people on probation and parole supervision and 33,000 people in prison. That's a lot of folks. As correctional professionals, what our job is to oversee the sanctions of the court, whatever that may be. It may be diversion, it may be probation, it may be parole. Missouri, we do both. Some states, they have counties that manage probation and parole, or probation and parole is separate. But in essence, our requirements are basically the same. Our job as professional correctionals is to help individuals become civil, sober, and contributing members to the community. Our job is to look at their areas of risk, do thorough assessment, and determine what the cause of their criminal behavior is. And what you probably all know is that 85% of the individuals that we deal with day in and day out are substance abusers. 85%. Their criminal behavior is motivated by substance abuse. And while their charge may not be for a drug offense or possession, it's their use of drugs and alcohol that serve as the underlying motivation and contributor to their criminal behavior. What we are charged with doing is identifying what we call their criminogenic risk. They're areas that we need to look at. And what we do is develop intervention plans and hold them accountable to those plans and hold them accountable to change. It's important for us to motivate the individual to want to make those changes. And we know that we can't alter behavior. What we do with probation and parole is we raise the bottom and we force individuals to make decisions. Again, we know that we cannot force people to change. But in the words of Father Joseph Martin, what we do know is that we can lead a horse to water, we can't make him drink, but we can certainly hold them there long enough to make him thirsty. Our job is to hold them there until they beg. Through the authority of the court or the parole board, we can require the client to participate in a variety of intervention programs, whether it's substance abuse, domestic violence, mental health. If it's deemed that the individual's use of alcohol negatively affects their behavior, we can direct them not to consume alcohol. And as you all know, in 1997, or prior to 1997, probation and parole officers routinely directed clients to attend AA meetings. But in 1997, the Supreme Court came back and said that we cannot compel or coerce someone to participate in a group that has a spiritual basis. And so what do we do? How do we motivate that? What we can do is we can direct an individual to participate in a treatment program. And generally, as part of that treatment program, the requirements is that they participate in a 12-step support group. What we can do is present them a list of options, be it AA, NA, or other secular-type groups. And then the individual has the option. Again, what we want to try and make sure that we do is do not violate First Amendment right of separation of church and state. But what our job as correctional professionals is to help motivate change. And so what we lay in front of the client is that you have a choice. You have an option. But you also have a desire. And what you want is you want to be off these papers. You want me out of your life. And so if you want me out of your life, one of the decisions you're going to have to make is to quit drinking and drugging. And here's an option. Here's an avenue and a road that you can go down through the steps of AA to help make those changes in your life. Once a decision is made that a client will attend AA, how do we support that client? How do we support that individual in their decision? Probation officers are very skilled at identifying negative behavior, and we are great at directing clients to attend programs, to complete tasks. But what we have to learn to do is how do we connect the dots? Again, it's very easy to tell a client, go to a meeting, have the chair sign your slip, and bring it back to me next week. But what we have to do is we have to put ourselves in the shoes of that client. We have to help them recognize, and we have to recognize, that there's going to be feelings of uncertainty, feelings of anxiety. Is this for me? What will it do? What does it mean? And we recognize that denial and anger is generally a secondary emotion to fear. And that's the primary emotion. Can I do it? Will I be accepted? How can I live my life? Will people like me? What happens if I fail? And so to help our staff, help individuals, to help clients, we've done a couple different things. One is that we offer AA meetings in our probation offices. Generally, these meetings are only open to clients under our supervision. And we as probation officers, we like those type of meetings. We can make sure that the client attends. We can schedule the client's office visit the same night that the meeting is held. And we don't need to worry about if the client can get his slip signed, or if it's in the wash, or if the dog ate it. Or we don't have to try and have the client explain to us why there's four different colors of ink on the same paper, all in the client's handwriting. Those sort of things that we have a tendency to figure out. And while it's easy for us, it's probably not the best way for an individual, for a client to be exposed to sober behavior and sober thoughts. And probably what ends up happening most times is they're in meetings with individuals that have the same type of sobriety, the same length of sobriety. And so what they don't do is they don't get the varying depths and degrees of sobriety that can be learned in different types of meetings, in step meetings, in 12-by-12. And so what we do is use that as a way to ease clients into that. And we don't want to diminish the value of those meetings, but again, we feel it's very important for individuals to be exposed to AA in those meetings and then go do meetings in the community. One of the things that we've been very fortunate is worked with the local AA community to also help ease clients into community-based meetings. And so a couple of the things that we've done is we've worked with the AA community to develop AA informational groups. These groups are designed to provide an elementary introduction to clients regarding AA. This is an 8-week group that's facilitated by members of the AA community and provides 1-hour lessons for 8 weeks. The topics include the types of meetings, where they're held. The individuals are given a copy of a where and when. They learn about sponsorship. The next 3 meetings focus on the 12 steps. There's a group meeting on spirituality and explains the spirituality aspect of AA. Traditions, and then next the literature, the big book, and a summary. And more importantly, an invitation to attend AA meetings within the community. Corrections, we assess, we refer, we introduce. And then the next step is how do we support the continuity of care for individuals who've been to AA meetings. Educators tell us that in order to facilitate learning, the concept needs to be supported by many different senses. And the same is true for changing behavior. As probation and parole officers, we have to support what a client learns. We have to support that through their daily interactions. Most of the staff that come to us that work with corrections, we have an elementary understanding of substance abuse, but we do not have a good understanding of AA. And so how do we help teach staff? The first is all new staff are required to attend an open AA meeting within their first 9 months of employment. It's on their new staff checklist, and it is something that they must do, and they must come back and be able to talk about that with the supervisor. What we've done in St. Louis is try to take that to the next step. Each district has had mandatory training in AA that is provided by members of the AA community. The training provides an overview that's not contained in a lesson plan. It's not presented through the eyes or the scope of corrections or through a lesson plan. But it puts the meat, the heart, and the soul of AA into the hands of staff. The AA members come in and they talk about the steps, the traditions, the anonymity, and relay their story in terms of how they achieve sobriety. The staff, this training is also offered every 6 months for new staff that come on board. And staff generally rate this training 10 out of 10 each and every time because it comes from the heart. And it helps them understand how they can help explain this to their clients. They also feel that it's very important for them to learn about AA from AA. We provide each probation officer in St. Louis a copy of a book called Partners in Change. And that book is not meant to be used as a novel, but to be used as a handbook. And again, that, coupled with the training that's offered by members of the AA community, helps them understand the steps, helps them understand that when they've got a client that's sitting across their desk and the individual says, I'm working step one, step two, they don't have to roll it through their brain in terms of what it is, but can refresh themselves, can look at it, to have an idea of what the questions they can ask. How do they support that? How do they direct? Our expectation for staff is not that they possess an in-depth understanding of each step, but that they can ask the questions, they can direct, they can redirect, and they can listen. They also learn of the need and the importance for an individual to have a sponsor and to understand what service means in terms of their group and in terms of the community. Partners in Change also provides them with some explanation in terms of how do you deal with resistance and remind staff that resistance is generally that secondary emotion that's covering that fear. And what's your response when a client says, this is not for me, I'm not comfortable, all they talk about is drinking and drugging. How do they do this? How can we not do this? I can't relate. I don't think I fit in. Again, help direct, redirect, and more importantly, listen. Within corrections, there's been a renewed effort to improve our outcomes and focus on those factors that help individuals remain successful in the community. In terms of corrections, with state budgets being what they are, with 48 out of 50 states incurring budget deficits, we can no longer afford to just provide individuals with three hots and a cot. We have to learn how we can alter behavior and how we can change behavior so that they don't remain in prison, so they don't go back to prison. One of the activities that we did is to try and connect people with AA prior to leaving prison. And I know Bridge the Gap has been very successful in some areas. We've had a little bit of difficulty with it in St. Louis. But one of the things that we've done with video conferencing equipment is try to connect individuals to AA before they leave prison. And what we have is video conferencing equipment in a number of our probation offices and then also in our institutions. And so what we're able to do is for individuals who are within a month of coming home, is we can bring them together and have members of the AA community come to one of our probation offices and talk about what it is to go to AA. Talk about meetings, talk about where they can go to a meeting, and help make that introduction and give some support in terms of when they walk out that there's a meeting for them to go to. We've had a little bit of difficulty with that, even with video conferencing equipment, because we can't bridge the gap between various institutions. And so what we find ourselves doing is taxing the AA community probably more than what we want to. So I know that we've talked about trying to develop a list of groups that are available for individuals that when they come home from prison, this is groups that you can go to that will accept you, that will help you. Within corrections, again, we've been relying upon the academic community to help us understand those factors and those areas that we need to look at and work on. And one of the things that they talk about is evidence-based practices. Again, to look at what the evidence says works with corrections. And when you look at those evidence-based practices, to me, the parallel to the AA community is uncanny. One of the things that we talk about doing is looking at criminogenic need. The first and the foremost area that needs to be looked on, according to the National Institute of Corrections, is cognitive restructuring. To look at the antisocial attitude, the values, and the beliefs of an individual. I often tell staff that AA is probably the earliest cognitive restructuring program available. And while folks will say it is spiritual in nature, it is. But it also carries very key elements of cognitive restructuring. Changing your thinking patterns, changing how you view things, keeping it simple. Look at the thought, realize that relapse begins with a thought and not the act. And that's what we try to teach clients in terms of how you change your thinking process. Criminogenic need, pro-criminal association. AA teaches you to change people, places, and things. Change those things around you that are inhibiting your behavior. Go to meetings, 90 meetings in 90 days. Obtain a sponsor. When I look at how we work with clients in the St. Louis area, one of the key factors for me is getting mentors, helping individuals obtain mentors. The sponsorship within AA lays the foundation for that for all of us and teaching us how we can use that mentorship, how we can use that sponsorship, not just with AA, but with other activities that we involve clients in. Intrinsic motivation, big surprise. making or allowing people to make the decision for themselves that they need to make changes in their life. We know in corrections we can't do that, but we help individuals to develop that intrinsic motivation, to help them within themselves make decisions. And what we do is we raise the bottom. Collaboration. When you look at collaboration, to me it's a no-brainer. If you help an entity or an organization work towards meeting its own goals, you meet your own goals within yourself. Our goals as corrections is to try and help people make changes, to help them make changes so that they don't go to prison. AA's mission is to help people find sobriety. And so where do we find where the two of those cross? But even with collaboration, it also means that you have to have a willingness to look at yourself. And if there are things that you are not doing as you should be doing, then you need to look at it and you need to try and fix it. I'm always very fortunate when Clem calls to say, Nancy, we got a little bit of a problem. We've got probation officers who are trying to asking their clients for their sponsors' information so they can call them. And how are we going to fix that? And Clem's sitting over there going, yeah, how are you going to fix that, Nancy? But those are the things that we need to be able to do to learn how we can work much closer together. With my own personal, within my own, when I first started with probation and parole 25 years ago, I did what a lot of probation officers do. I referred a client to AA. I gave them a long piece of paper. I said, I want it filled up by the end of the month. I want you to bring it back. And I took it and I threw it in a file. And I didn't understand the profound effect AA can have on a client's behavior. And I didn't understand the influence that I could have on helping the client understand the steps and traditions. My own brother struggled with chemical dependency for a number of years. He was in and out of treatment. He had a few geographical escapes. He was back into treatment, slipping to relapse. And he would attend AA, but his attendance would be motivated more by his desire to appease others and to keep others off his back. And at some point during this insanity, Mike found a sponsor. And found a sponsor that held him to working the steps and forced him to look at his behavior and what he needed to do. And the changes in his own life were significant. And again, made that impression upon me in terms of what the fellowship had to offer, not just to him, but to other individuals. I also considered myself very blessed. Within corrections, we probably have our fair share of individuals who are in recovery themselves. But I had a supervisor, Richard, who understood sobriety, but much more understood fellowship, and was very easy to be able to bring your client to Richard, and he could explain and work with that client and teach us what we needed to know and help problem solve with the client, with him, in terms of where we needed to go. I hope that in my role within corrections that I'm hoping that I can help promote and help lead, but I also appreciate all the work that you do. And so I thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I think one of the things with AA service is sometimes you don't get to see the results of all the work you do automatically, unlike working with someone in person. Yesterday I was on an elevator and there were two women from Pinehurst, North Carolina on the elevator. I joked around with one of them because in 1991, 92, I used to tell people that I was moving to Pinehurst. Now, I'd never been there. I'd never been to North Carolina at that point. But somehow, at a correctional facility on Long Island, in a minimum correctional facility, a warden made a decision that we were allowed to have Walkman. Now, I'm dating myself, I know. I used to be young in AA, but I'm not young anymore. So a Walkman without an AM/FM, but just cassette, so it didn't interfere with the guards' radios. And this warden let speaker tapes come in. And I listened to a speaker tape one week, and I hated AA again, because the speaker said, sobriety time in jail doesn't count. And so I was furious. And I had had a love affair and a hate affair with AA since I'd been 15 years old. And so I was back to hating AA. Because for anyone that knows, it's not easy to work spiritual principles behind those walls. And so if you have a day of sobriety, it is worth every bit as much as anyone else's day of sobriety. But a week later, I went back to that same library, to that same cardboard box. And on top of the box was a tape that said, Tom I. Pinehurst or Aberdeen, North Carolina. And I remember listening to that tape, and I don't know if it was 3 years or 5 years before that somebody did something to get that tape in there. And I remember the first time, 2 years later, I picked up a phone. I met a taper at some conference, and I asked him if he knew this guy named Tom I. And I remember I called the North Carolina Department of Corrections and got Tom I's assistant. And, but I know that I don't know who brought that tape in. And sometimes that's the thing with doing AA service, is you don't know later on the lives that it can impact, even if you don't see the results right away. And I can think of no better person to wrap up this session than these two excellent speakers than Jim Estelle, the past chairperson of the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. Jim?
My name is Jim Estelle, and I'm an everlasting, grateful friend of Alcoholics Anonymous. The last hour I've spent listening to two professionals, and they are professionals. I wonder where they were when I was hiring people who claimed to be professionals. All you people who raised your hands earlier that you were carrying the message in, you're the reason I'm really here. I'm still trying to pay off a debt of gratitude for y'all saving my job when I was young in the business. And some of you have heard this story before, but I'm going to tell it again. After spending several years as a very young correctional officer, I'm still recovering from that, I was assigned pretty much by my own choice, I guess, because they wouldn't promote me from within the uniform ranks as soon as I thought was appropriate. So I left the captain's office in kind of a huff, and he said, "Well, wait a minute, son, where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to go be a parole officer and get over being 25. And nobody, in my opinion, and it's my opinion, but it ought to be yours too, nobody 25 years old should be assigned as a parole officer. I did not have the patience, the tolerance, the creativity. I did not have life's experiences that prepared me to be a decent parole officer. About 6 months after I was on that assignment, my supervisor handed me an envelope with discharge papers from a convict who had been on parole longer than I had been alive. And I was supposed to deliver these discharge papers to him. I knew the fella. And he lived up in the mountains where my caseload was primarily located. I went up there one evening and big deal. I'm giving him his parole discharge after these many, many years. And then I made the 25-year-old's mistake. I began to preach to him. And he said, "Just a minute, Mr. Estelle." And he's clutching that discharge paper in his hand. He says, "I've got something for you." And he went to the back of the shotgun shack. And it had been a while since I'd been looked down the barrel of a loaded gun, and I was afraid this is what he might be coming out with. But anyway, he came out, and he's holding a book in his hand, and he said, "Just in case anybody in Sacramento or you think y'all had anything to do with my getting this discharge," he said, "I hope one day you'll take time to read this book and then pass it on." Guess what? It was probably a first edition. And I'm glad I passed it on. I hope somebody made use of it. If I had locked up every drunk parolee that I came across and violated his parole, I'd have been fired. Just no question about it. I wouldn't have had a caseload. That's how critical it was in those days. But I found out pretty quickly that there was help in the community that I did not realize. But a few alcoholic parolees helped me out. And so when I called Salvation Army or Alcoholics Anonymous, neither one of those outfits ever said no. Never said no. I said, send that fellow over. So I would go to the county jail, and he'd been there for 3 or 4 days and could understand now what I was saying. And I'd say, your first appointment is going to this AA meeting. Give him the time, the phone number, the address. And I said, you got a decision to make. You're going to make those parole or make those AA meetings, or I'm going to have to take you back. There wasn't a whole lot of counseling went on about that conversation. And I wasn't prepared to do the counseling. If there was, should have been. But it began to work. And I made up my mind when I went back into uniform and went back to institutional work, if I ever worked in a program or an institution where AA was coming in, they were going to get a warm welcome. And I tried to live by that throughout the rest of my career. Y'all did what I was not qualified to do. And when I became a manager in corrections and a director of a rather large system, not many of my employees were qualified to do what you do. And you learned it out of the big book. And you learned it from somebody's big-footed sponsors. Yeah. I'm a firm believer in sponsorship. It's better than a master sergeant in the Army. Not many choices to be made. Decisions are going to be made. No choices, just decisions. And if you want it, I don't have to tell y'all, or you wouldn't be here. You got it. You wanted it. And you convince your sponsees that they want it. Like one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. It ain't rocket science. Neither is managing a prison rocket science. If I can find the people that understand that. You fix a broken window. You repair a toilet that won't flush properly. And you find somebody to erase graffiti that was put on the wall of the mess hall one night. Simple as that. And you do that with your sponsees. You make repairs as you find them. And you do it without apology or without misgivings, because somebody did it for you. You thought at the time they were doing it to you. Now we've got institutional programs staffed with people who understand that. And I was really appreciative of hearing about y'all's programs. Because right now, where I'm paying taxes, well, someplace you've read that I'm living in California now. And I've worked for 3 different correctional systems. And when I left California the first time, I wasn't willing to tolerate the level of violence that was occurring there, and I got tired of investigating assaults and homicides, and that's not what I went to work in institutions for. Now, about 5, 6 years ago, why, they used to call California's prison system CDC, Department of Corrections. Then we got a new governor came in, and then the legislature saw fit to add R to that. Now it's California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Within the last year, they've fired over half of their teachers, both vocational and academic. And they have episodes of shutting the gate to all volunteer groups. trying to come into our prisons. We need bread, and I'm sure that there's, you know, the fence doesn't go up in California. We have bred in this nation, I'm afraid, a whole generation of bureaucrats who think if they don't pay massive millions of dollars to some contractor to come in and do what they're paid to do, that it's not going to work. They're scared one time, you folks, because you don't demand payment for what you do. They have no concept of why you do it. It's pitiful. Absolutely pitiful. And I don't care whether they're religious volunteers, AA volunteers, whatever it is, who's willing to work with a bunch of sorry convicts that need help. And the staff that we hire today are interested in just a couple of things. Payday and keeping them there. And there are whole organizations who are making sure that their membership is well paid and keeping the convicts in prison. Now you can draw your conclusions where I stand on that kind of oh, my. Then I have to apologize for the fact that I was raised in a Quaker family. There's a way to get to some of those bureaucrats. There's a way to get to them. And it's the same tools that you use on getting to your sponsees every once in a while. Warden, I need your help to keep and maintain my sobriety. Won't you help me? Now, even wardens brought up in the world that they know, they don't like to be seen as people who won't help people. So if you're having problems getting into a jail, and I understand that, that's even tougher sometimes than getting into a state or federal prison, because every 4 years you've got a new sheriff, and he didn't get elected by saying, I'm going to let all the volunteers into my jail. Just didn't work that way today. But if you go to the sheriff or the warden and say, I need help maintaining my sobriety, and this is how we do it in AA, just give him a little 101 in the basic of AA. Fifth tradition, 12th step, just those two. If you work on that a little bit with it. Nobody wants to walk down the street with a broken down retired warden, let me tell you. Teachers and preachers in the community are, you know, they see their successes in the grocery store, at the theater, where, you know, 4th of July celebrations, everybody meets them and greets them. Big deal. And I do that too. But it ain't really popular to be seen walking down the street arm in arm or on the hand on the shoulder with an old warden. Doesn't make sense. You might also try, when you've got a successful program going into these two programs, send in the warden, the volunteer coordinator, a Christmas card, an Easter card, a note, thank you for helping me maintain my sobriety, warden. Couldn't have done it without you. You open your gates. You're letting your convicts hear about how they can make your institution safer, cleaner, and quieter. Unless you think I'm an altruistic bureaucrat, there ain't no such animal. I was interested in the institutions that I worked in and managed being safe and quiet and clean. And you volunteers that came in did things that my staff couldn't or wouldn't do because they weren't qualified. And on those rare occasions, was there some small insurrection or upset? I knew where the AA people were. If they weren't on their job, they were in their drum. And they were trying to tell their neighbors, don't do this to my house. Don't do this to my house. So I wasn't always altruistic totally. I've been in general service since 1976. And the reason I'm so strong on sponsorship is because I didn't know anything about AA, except I knew that you really emphasized sponsorship. And so when I was invited to service by a couple of gentlemen, one of them was a non-alcoholic former trustee, the other one was a former trustee who was a real alcoholic. And I said, if my board will let me do what you asked me to do, which is to join the Board of Trustees, if my board will agree to that, there's one more condition. I said, you're going to be my non-alcoholic sponsor, and you're going to be my alcoholic sponsor. And I had two of the best sponsors in the United States, as far as I'm concerned, because they let me survive. They let me survive, and I was a rank amateur. Still am, because I'm still unqualified to do what you do so successfully. And so I'm, you know, people say, what the heck is a non-alcoholic doing spending this many years, this much time working with AA? I'm still paying you back for keeping my job. And every once in a while, somebody will call, say, we're having trouble getting into this prison or that jail and so forth. And I'll go through the ritual that I've just gone through with you. Well, did you send them a Christmas card last Christmas? Have you told them how pleased you are with your sobriety? How well my wife treats me now that I'm busy on these weekends? That's the other thing. Some of you travel, you know, like 100 miles in a snowstorm. Or in a South Texas heat wave. And you get to the gate and the officer says, hey, there ain't no meeting today. We're on lockdown. I hope you don't go away really angry or upset. The officer didn't make that decision. And he's probably going to be on the gate next week when you come back. Don't make him any more upset than he is already, because he's going to have to work overtime. Smile and say, thanks a lot. We'll be back next week. And you had a meeting going down there to the prison. You had a meeting going home. And that was, you know, 2 out of 3 isn't bad. See, I've also reached a point in working with y'all that I can't read all of my notes. There's a couple of other little sidebar projects that you can get involved in. And we all know the practices of AA regarding anonymity and publicity at the level of press. Radio, TV, and all of that good stuff. But you know some people that know some people. And if you just happen to have a conversation with one of those people that know some people about, did you know that they've got 3 groups out there at that prison? 3 AA groups going on out there at that prison? No. Really? Yeah. And pretty soon, somebody else knows about it. And pretty soon, there's a newspaper reporter talking to the warden or the volunteer coordinator out there. Is it true? But you've got three AA groups out here at this prison? Well, no, it's not true. We've got four. And he wants to do a story about it. We made the front page of the San Antonio paper this morning. Did you all see that? Fantastic. And nobody's anonymity was compromised. But the people, the good citizens of San Antonio, begin to understand what y'all are laughing and giggling and smiling about. That's important. It's important because they've all got friends and neighbors who need your help. So that kind of an image is not compromising anybody's anonymity. And we're concerned about the flattening out of the growth of our fellowship on this continent. And we need to do some creative things without compromising our anonymity. We can do it to help that flattening out. The other thing is that none of you beat down the doors of the jail or prison you're going into to get in there when you first started. Those of you who hadn't done any time were scared to death of the slamming of the door behind you because you wondered if you were ever going to get out of there. Somebody sponsored you in there. And a whole lot of times it wasn't an invitation. It was get in the car. Where are we going? Get in the car. And maybe it didn't take, and some of you have tried to sponsor folks like that, and it doesn't take on some people. And the worst thing you can do is to have people have a bad reaction to what could be a good experience. It's, but we've seen people come in and go out. They come back usually. And so when I hear some of you folks that are faithful to the cause complaining that we don't have enough volunteers, remember how you got there the first time. You all got sponsees. Every one of you has got 1, 2, 3, half a dozen sponsees. Have you taken them in yet? I did about run you out of time, Billy. But I really want to reiterate, God bless these professionals that understand a whole lot more than I did at their age and stage in life about what you're about, what you're doing. And don't forget to thank those people that do that for us. There are half a dozen ways that I haven't even talked about that you can thank people for doing for us. And again, I just appreciate it. And my gratitude will never end because the three states I worked for fed my family very well. And I appreciate you allowing me to stay in the business for as long as I did. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. I know we all have a big meeting to get to tonight. I'm going to close. It's amazing to me, non-alcoholics and their view of AA. But with my favorite non-alcoholic, I'm going to close with her description of Alcoholics Anonymous and what AA did for her. In 1995 in San Diego, I called my mother on a cell phone. No, on a payphone. On a payphone. Before I shared at the young people's meeting there. And so today I find myself, I don't have a mom to call physically anymore. Spiritually, another word. But I want to share her view of AA because I have no Al-Anon jokes. I say it all the time. And I know there are places around the country now where Al-Anon is bringing meetings into correctional facilities, which is outstanding. And but for the grace of Al-Anon, the Worldwide Fellowship Al-Anon Family Group, I wouldn't be here today. if some fellowship had not taught my mom to get out of the way of the bottom that God had planned for her son, I would not be a speaker. But in 2000 or 1999, Christmas 1999, she was in a hospice in her final weeks of this life. And I remember Christmas Eve because I watched all my siblings wrap their last gifts for my mom, myself included, and it was very difficult. And the next morning, Christmas Day 1999, I got up early. I checked some emails. I went and got two large Dunkin' Donuts coffees. I got my mom's wig, her eyeshadow, her makeup, her Charlie perfume, pictures of her cat, and some crazy Irish music, and her CD player. And I went to her hospice early that morning. It would be the last Christmas she was with us, and family member was coming by. But if you've ever been with someone who's in their final weeks like that, they kind of hallucinate sometimes. You're not really sure if they're talking to you or... And my mom said the most significant thing about Alcoholics Anonymous to me that's ever been said, which is, and she said, what Alcoholics Anonymous gave me was the ability to go get a quart of milk. Now, that sounds kind of crazy. Which I said to my mom, that sounds kind of crazy. As I was sitting in her bed with her with the back propped up, throwing back two tall boy Dunkin' Donuts like we were drinking Budweiser's, I had put her wig on and her makeup the best I could. And I said, Mom, what do you mean AA gave you a quart of milk? And she said, well, Billy, there was a time in your life and my life when if it came that I ran out of something at night and it was a choice between going to the market, but then I would have to deal with the question, the most fearful question that I would not want to hear at all, which is, how are your children? Or how is Billy? That I would choose to do without. And that what Alcoholics Anonymous gave me was at a certain point in time, I couldn't wait for somebody to ask me that question in the supermarket. She was the greatest promoter of Alcoholics Anonymous I ever ran into. I'm not sure how good she was with my anonymity, but that's not my business with her. But it is amazing to me.